Shrink Wrap Radio number 335, The Archetypal Couple, with Jungian analyst Tamar Krohn.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Israeli Jungian analyst Dr. Tamar Krohn, and we will be discussing her very illuminating book, The Archetypal Couple. Tamar Krohn, PhD, is a clinical psychologist and Jungian analyst. She is head of the Clinical Psychology Graduate Program at the Academic College of Tel Aviv, and she has a private practice in Jerusalem. Her main research interests are dreams, the therapeutic relationship, postpartum depression, and the couple relationship. Dr. Krohn published articles and books on the above subjects, and she's written three novels. In her recent book, The Archetypal Couple, she explores the life cycle of the couple, weaving together Greek mythology, Old Testament stories, and her own experience as a couple's therapist. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Tamar Krohn, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hi, I'm very glad to be here.
Well, it's great to finally have you on the show. We should let listeners know that you and I met at last summer's International Association for the Study of Dreams conference in Berkeley, and we really hit it off. And you gave me a copy of your book then, and I've been meaning to have you on Shrink Wrap Radio ever since. So welcome again.
That's fine.
Okay. Well, you are a Jungian analyst, and you're also, I guess, originally a clinical psychologist. Where did you get your Jungian training?
I got my Jungian training here in Jerusalem, Israel.
Oh, so there is an institute there?
Yeah, we have an institute. It's called the Israeli Institute for Jungian Psychology.
Ah, very interesting. I didn't know that. And so tell us about your call to become a Jungian analyst. I've spoken to other analysts, and usually there's some kind of interesting story about, you know, what put them on this path, because it's not an easy path necessarily. So how did you get the call?
Right. For many years I was, a psychodynamic therapist. All my training was in the psychoanalytic tradition. And at that time I worked in the psychiatric hospital. And it's interesting because actually I got to Jung through Martin Buber, although Carl Jung and Martin Buber had a terrible quarrel.
Oh, you say they did or they would have?
They did have.
Oh, my goodness. I didn't know that.
They did have because of the issue of, is there God or is God only a projection of our self archetype?
Uh-huh.
In any case, when I worked in the psychiatric hospital about 15 years ago, I realized that the relationships between the staff and the patients has something more to do than, you know, just kind of therapist patients and interpretations and so on. And I started to read Martin Buber about the dialogue. And then I had this dream, a very, very deep dream for me. It was actually a turning point for me. Shall I tell you the dream?
Yes, if you don't mind.
Yeah, I don't, because I wrote it also in my books.
Okay. Good.
So in the dream, I had a patient at that time in the hospital, and she used always to, you know, to watch me when we sat together and say things like, oh, Tamar, you are probably such a good mother and I'm such a bad mother. We had children of the same age at that time. and you are my savior, you are my angel, and I'm so bad, and so on and so forth. And in a way, I probably, unconsciously, I accepted her things. I mean, I accepted the split that she made between me and her.
Sure.
And then I had this dream that I'm walking down the street in the center of Jerusalem, and all the shops are closed. So I realize it's Shabbat, you know, our Saturday.
Yes.
And there is no one on the street. And there I see her coming from down there, coming towards me. And we go one towards the other. And as we come closer, I see that she's dressed with my clothes. Hmm. And she asks me, Tamar, why do we meet on Shabbat? And I say, because I promised you. That was the dream.
What did that dream mean to you?
I worked on this dream and thought about this dream for a long time. And first I realized it's a dialogue. It's a dialogue between us.
Mm-hmm.
And then I realized that it's not that I'm the good mother and she's the bad mother, because she's dressed with my clothes, which means that she's me in a way, right?
Yes.
And I realized that we have, both of us, have the two poles. She's the good mother and the bad mother. And I'm also the good mother and the bad mother.
Yes. Yep.
And this helped me in helping her coming out of her split, you see?
Okay.
You know, I told her then she suffered from postpartum depression,
uh-huh.
A delayed postpartum depression, which really lasted for 6 years or so. Her child was 6 years old at the time.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So I started to tell her about what a mother I am. You know, that sometimes I get angry and I shout at my boy, and it's not that I'm always the very best mother in the world and so on. And slowly, slowly, we came to the point where she could, you know, realize her pole of a good mother, and her behavior changed.
Oh, that's wonderful.
This, for me, was really a turning point, and it opened the way, you know, to the Jungian training, to the learning the Jungian theory.
Yes.
Especially dreams. I'm enthusiastic about dreams.
Right. Me too, as you know. And that's how we ended up meeting at a dream conference, for sure.
Yeah, right.
Now, in your work as a Jungian analyst, would you say that you've specialized in working with couples? I mean, you've written this book called The Archetypal Couple, and you give a case example or two in every chapter.
Yeah.
So is that your specialty, would you say?
Well, you know, I work with individuals, I even work with groups, but my warm point is for couples. Because, and it's interesting because when you try to look for something written about couples by Jungian writers, you don't find much. I mean, you really find very little. Jung himself wrote only one article about marriage as a psychological relationship. That's the name of the article. And I have this feeling that there are so many myths about couples in the Indian mythology, in the Greek mythology, in the Jewish mythology, I mean the Old Testament, the Bible, and in many, and of course the big northern myth, and in the German mythology, and the old German mythology, and I'm sure that in many other mythologies. So I believe that these myths live within us. You know, at first I wanted to call the book Mythology in the Bedroom, but then I decided it's a little, well, you know. it doesn't fit a book like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, you and I, you know, met and hung out as friends. And so I really I got to meet you in a different way in reading your book. And I must say, I'm in awe of your scholarship, that you're a scholar and clearly a scholar and intellectual, and you've really studied mythology. Having said that, you write about the couple archetype and myth. In a broad way, what would you say, what is the couple archetype and how is it illuminated by myth?
Well, in a broad way, like you say, again, the couple archetype is not mentioned by Jung, I must say, either by other Jungians, but I believe there is a couple archetype. It's mentioned by Jung in another way when he talks about the conjunctio.
Yes.
When he talks about the holy marriage, mm-hmm. and in his book on transference, he brings the rosarium, and the rosarium, which is he interprets the rosarium as a symbolic way to describe the psychotherapy, not only the psychotherapy, also the you would call it the psychological relationship and the conjunctio. They're the king and the queen. They unite at the end of the rosarium, and there is this spiritual creature hovering over them, because the conjunctio is the marriage on earth and the marriage up there. And in Kabbalah, in our Jewish Kabbalah, there is the same idea. In the Kabbalah, it is said that every togetherness of the couple down on earth is a togetherness of the God and the Shekhinah. The Shekhinah is the female part of God, and up there in the sky, would you say? So I think we are talking about couple archetype.
Okay, well, let's. I was also struck by a statement that you made that myth does not offer solutions to our essential problems or offer guidance in any particular direction. And so that raises the question, well, what's it good for then? Can you say a bit about that?
Yeah, I think I'm saying it in the book, in every chapter. It's true. Myth doesn't lend us a solution. I mean, it's not, you know, when you read mythology, you're not reading a book of how to solve your problems. But what it gives you, a widening of your narrow life. When you're feeling that you are cornered, yeah, you're cornered in your life and in your problems. And there is this myth which tells about archetypes, I would say, symbolically. You feel that you're not alone in this world. You feel that your problems are connected to human problems all over the world and in all times.
Yes.
And you can also feel the spiritual dimension.
Mm-hmm.
For example, there is a chapter in my book on Hephaestus and Aphrodite, who are a very strange couple. Aphrodite is disgusted by Hephaestus.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you about that further on. So let's not go into detail about that one yet, but I thought that's kind of in the last chapter of your book. And I certainly understand what you're saying about getting a broader view of our life through myth. And also, I think Shakespeare was very good on that in his tragedies. And speaking of it connecting to our lives, I'm sure you've heard of medical school syndrome, in which medical students experience all the symptoms of the diseases that they're learning about. And I experienced something similar as I was reading in your book.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I was seeing a bit of myself in not only the myths, but also the case histories with the couples.
Uh-huh.
It was not entirely comfortable.
Yes, but in a way, it's like, I think it opens the way to think, you know, to think in a different way about your life and about your couple relationship.
Yes.
Because myths are also paradoxical, like the archetype, and they bring to you the poles, you know?
Yes.
The two poles.
Right. Now, you mentioned the alchemical idea of conjunctio, and what's the relationship between Jung's idea of the inner marriage and the outer marriage? I mean, even if we'd done a lot of work on the inner marriage of owning our anima and our animas, it seems like we still have a strong yearning for an actual outer partner. Do you find that to be true?
Just tell me, what is your main point in your question?
Well, I asked you two questions, I guess.
Yeah, okay.
So you can talk about Jung's idea of the inner marriage and the outer marriage first, I guess. So say a little bit more about that. What's the relationship between the two?
I can say, even if Jung didn't say it, that we have a developmental process here. And I also describe this in my book. In the first stages, we project so much of our inner poles and of our inner archetypes on the partner. And we don't see the partner as he or she is in reality. And this, of course, makes the relationship unreal in many, many ways. And it must bring to a catastrophe and to the disappointment, to crisis. It usually happens in midlife, but sometimes it happens earlier.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
When your partner doesn't fit all your projections, of course, the partner projects on you too. And there is no real inner marriage and no real outer marriage. Now, when you take back your projections, and this is a very long and painful process, and I have to add here that mythology helps you in this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the therapist can use mythology in helping taking back the projections. When you take most of your projections, because even Jung says you never take all the projections back, and you start to see your partner as a real person, and you start to get into real dialogue with your partner and not an imagined dialogue, which is actually with your inner animus or anima, then there can be a real inner marriage and a real outer marriage. I mean, they fit together. Did I say it clearly?
Yes. Yes,
okay.
you did say it clearly. My follow-up point that I asked before was that even if you, let's say that you're not in an outer marriage, but you've been doing a lot of work on yourself and getting in touch with your inner anima or animus and, you know, and just doing a lot of inner work, it seems like that's, while that's helpful and necessary in the developmental process, it's no substitute for an actual outer partner. That's my opinion.
And sure.
there's still that yearning for a real partner.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. In couple therapy, most of this inner work is done with a couple.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you that it's really a very deep and moving experience to sit with a couple and one of them is talking or bringing a dream and the other listens, and you can see on the face of the listener how moving it is for, for him or her, and how many times it's like a new experience.
Yeah. Now, because there is no body of Jungian theory about couples work, I gather, and because Jung didn't write about it very much, I'm wondering, have you developed your own theory or your own approach to working with couples? And if so, is that something that you can briefly describe?
Yeah. Well, in the first chapter of my book, The Archetypal Couple, I bring what I call the life cycle of the couple. A couple has a life cycle like an individual. Mm-hmm. And it's not that every couple fits exactly to the stages of this life cycle, but you can find it, I would say, in most couples. And the first stage is the blind love. The blind love is actually a love of projections. You fall in love with your projected anima or animus, with your inner figure. I call it the figure of the dreams.
That's the stage that we call infatuation. And it's interesting that if that's all projection, that it's interesting that we get so high off that we get so wonderfully excited and the world is magical.
Yeah, right. And then you also feel that you are so similar to each other. You are so much like each other. It's like your twin is there and you were born to be together and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And each one of you tries to fit him or herself into that image of the other. Of course, this doesn't hold for long, right?
Right.
So the next stage will be awakening from the dream, I would say. And this usually entails disappointment and even despair. And there is the big crisis. So usually couples come at this stage, and usually only one of them is the first to be in that crisis, and the other one would react to that.
Yeah.
Or one of them would like to change something and tries to change, and the other one would do all the manipulations not to change, to bring the other back to the former position.
Yes.
Former behavior. Here, the therapist can intervene. I mean, this is the work of the therapist, you know, to show both partners how they continue to project.
Uh-huh.
Show that one is moving and the other is trying to block. And the main thing is to give them hope, you know, to give them hope that we'll come out of that crisis. There is hope in this crisis.
Uh-huh.
And that the way to come to a better state of to a better couple life will be to realize who your partner really is, and then to try to get into this open dialogue one with the other. You would be amazed to know how many couples, after 20 years or so of living together, when they are in therapy, reveal, you know, thoughts and thoughts and dreams and even experiences, and the other would say, "Oh, I never knew this. I never knew this from you."
Yeah.
No? So it brings hope of a new life. I would say that when you get to this part of the dialogue, you are on the third stage. You are coming out of the crisis.
Okay. Moving back to myth and so on, I particularly like the section in which you talked about fairy tales dealing with embracing the hag or kissing the monster and what that means for us in terms of growth in the relationship. How does that relate to what you were just saying about the stages?
Yeah, you know, I love this fairy tale about the frog. There are two versions of this fairy.
Me too.
You do?
Yeah, yeah. I've often, if we're talking about the same one, I'm thinking of the one where the princess drops her golden ball into the pond. And I've referred to that a lot in my teaching over the years.
But you know that there are two versions of it.
No, I don't. Go ahead.
Yeah, one is the German, the Grimm's brother, brutal version, but it's a very interesting one. And one is, the sweeter one.
yes, right.
Because in the German original version, what happens is that the princess gets into a rage, and she takes this frog and throws the frog brutally on the wall.
Oh yes, I do.
And by that, the kind of possession that he's in, he's free from it, and lo and behold, this frog on the wall becomes the prince, comes out of as the prince. So we are talking here about aggression, you know?
Yes.
About a rage, which is a rage, an authentic rage, you know? When you allow yourself to be angry and to express your anger, and you don't swallow it and hide it, and then it boils inside you and you can get sick. And by the act of I tell a little something about a case that I had just this day?
Sure.
Relating to this?
Yes.
So here is this couple. They are married now for about 20 years and have 4 children. And he is this kind of sweet, kind man. Everybody loves him, you know. He would never harm anybody. And the wife is there. More active, he's a little passive. The wife is more active, assertive, and of course she's, maybe aggressive, you would call it.
Okay.
Now, she gets really, he makes her crazy with his nice way and his being this sweet man, right? But she feels that underneath it, there is so much aggression, so much anger. So she starts to, in the sessions, she starts to, sometimes she has this, she bursts out with her being so, how would I call it? She gets into real despair when she tries to, to move him and to get him out of this attitude of victimizing himself in a way,
Yeah, so she gets frustrated and angry.
Yeah, frustrated and angry.
Mm-hmm.
And then he says, if you leave me, I will commit suicide.
Uh-huh.
Can you imagine? So she gets really furious. What are you doing? What is this kind of manipulation?
Yeah.
Again, you go in the same way. You victimize yourself as if, this is an unconscious manipulation, of course. And here you present yourself as being completely dependent on me. And now I'm stuck here with this kind of dependence. See?
Yes.
So when I intervene, I show both of them the pattern, because this goes on and on, again and again and again and again. Whenever she tries to, to move him from this place where he is, he would manipulate his victimization, as if victimization. And then it gets stuck again.
Is seeing the pattern sufficiently powerful to bring about change? You know, that's one sort of criticism.
I think so.
Mm-hmm.
I think that when, for example, in this case, the husband realizes that his pattern is just making things worse, and if he's really motivated to change, of course, a therapist can't do anything without the patient being motivated to change. Then he will move.
Okay. You have a nice way of stating profound insights very simply. For example, I like your statement in the book that our intimate relationships are ruled by two opposing needs, the need for security and stability on the one hand, and the need for excitement and unpredictability. Can you say a bit about these two poles and the role they play in relationship difficulties?
Yes, I must say that I learned it from Stephen Mitchell. He writes about it in his book, Can Love Last?
Uh-huh.
You know this book?
I don't.
Yeah, well, it's worth reading this book. And he believes, and I believe too, that in each of us we have these opposing wishes, you know?
Mm-hmm.
The one way we wish to be we wish to have the confidence that this relationship is forever, and we have this, we wish for stability, we wish for, you know, kind of, I would say the wish, like the baby's wish that the mother will always be there, always, always, always be there whenever the baby wants her. And she will forever be there and cuddle him and feed him whenever he needs it.
Mm-hmm.
This is a very deep wish, an early wish that is with us all our life. But on the other hand, we have the opposing wish to, you know, to get excitement in life, to find something new, to get out of our usual routine, and that someone will come and bring us new colors into our life.
Yeah. Yeah, I can certainly identify with both of those poles.
Everyone can.
Yeah, yeah. You do a beautiful job of exploring the biblical myth of Adam and Eve as it relates to couples, and it's a myth that I'm sure everyone is familiar with, and at the same time, as you point out, it's also quite mysterious, and you unpack so many meanings from it that that one story could take up all of our time in this interview. So rather than do that, let me ask you to focus just on the element of the serpent. So many of us have had snake dreams. I myself used to have many snake dreams.
Yeah.
So tell us about the significance of the serpent in the Adam and Eve myth as it relates to couples.
Well, you know, there is the conventional story, which was used by rabbis, priests, whoever is... the aim of which is to keep the gates closed, I would
yeah,
say.
Yeah, or maintain a power structure.
Yeah, right. And this conventional myth, story, the story about the couple in the Garden of Eden, and in the Garden of Eden, they are in the hand, you know, like children of God. And they have no knowledge. Knowledge means actually being aware, self-awareness, and consciousness. And they live there very happy because they are unaware, right?
Yes.
And here comes the serpent, like a third element, and he ruptures the two. He ruptures this kind of Edenic, I would say even, actually the couple in the Garden of Eden is in many ways similar to the first stage that we talked about before, you know, the blind love.
Yeah, and actually I'm realizing that it's similar to the frog story that we talked about before, right?
Right. You're right. That's why I like the the German brutal version.
Yes.
More than the one that the princess kisses the frog and there he is, the prince, you know.
So there are always two stories. There's the nice, sweet story, and there's the darker Jungian story.
Yeah, right. So the serpent here is considered by the Judeo-Christian tradition as, the negative element, the Satan, the evil, and the serpent brought the fall.
Yes.
This fall that now we are doomed, you know, and so on and so forth.
Right.
But you can look at that story from a completely different point of view. You can look at it as a story of transformation.
Mm-hmm.
This couple that lives unaware and without consciousness, they are awakened by the serpent that comes in, mm-hmm. you know, serpent. Wow. Stirs this Edenic life and by force brings them to transformation. Because before they met the serpent and before God threw them out brutally out of the Garden of Eden, they didn't even have sex. They didn't even have children. It all started after they were thrown out, after the fall. Would you say that having sex and having children is a fall?
No.
Right?
Right.
And, you know, when we look at the symbols of the apple and the tree, these are symbols also of individuation and transformation and of the self.
Yes.
All this comes when the serpent comes in. And so, and the serpent is a symbol of transformation. Because the serpent sloughs his skin every year, and then new skin grows on, right? That's
yeah,
why the serpent
right.
is also the symbol of medicine and of healing.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
even though the serpent can kill you very easily.
Mm-hmm.
So the serpent is paradoxical, like all the archetypes and all the symbols.
Yes. Yes, that's such a different take on the serpent and the whole Garden of Eden story. I really appreciate your take on it. I could have used that years ago when I was, well, I don't want to go too deeply into the story, but I was being confronted by an angry father of a young woman with whom I was involved. And he trotted out the story of the Garden of Evil to impress upon me how wicked sex was.
Oh.
And I didn't have, I felt he was wrong, but I didn't have the tools at my disposal then to give a good rebuttal. Now, lots of listeners will be familiar with Pygmalion from My Fair Lady, which tells the story of a professor who tries to win a bet by remaking a girl from the lower classes into someone who can pass as upper class. And as we already observed, there seem to always be two stories. The actual Pygmalion myth is somewhat different than that. So tell us about Pygmalion and Galatea as it relates to relationships.
Pygmalion, I call him a new stage of Narcissus, you know?
A new stage of what?
Narcissus?
Yes, okay. A further development of from the narcissistic position.
Right.
Yeah.
Because you can say that Pygmalion is not in love with himself, but he's in love with his creation.
Mm-hmm.
And why did he create this beautiful sculpture, woman sculpture? Because he couldn't love any living woman on earth, right?
Okay.
So it's a narcissistic kind of love.
Yes.
And of course, it symbolizes your image, the image you have inside that and that you project on women outside or men. You can take Pygmalion from the woman's point of view or from the man's point of view. It doesn't matter. And a woman can also be a Pygmalion.
So this is where we try to shape our partner to fit
right.
our the projection that we have.
Right, right. You project your inner image, and then you try to make the partner fit into that image, to shape the partner. And many times, partners would shape themselves, you know, in order to be accepted and loved, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
But then what happens, and this is, I describe it also in my in the chapter about Pygmalion, it can, of course, happen that Galatea, after Pygmalion asked Aphrodite to help him and to bring this sculpture to life, and she became a real woman, they lived happily after. But who says they lived happily after? Maybe Galatea one day woke up and said, "Hey, I don't want to be shaped anymore, you know? I don't want your projections on me. I want to live my life, my real life, my real self." And or Pygmalion would be bored with this creature that he shaped. He shaped it so nicely that now it's boring, you know? And yeah. I also, the couple can be a Pygmalion. The couple has an image. How a couple to be. And then they shape themselves according to the image.
You know, some people have pointed out that we live a lot longer than we used to. And so consequently, we live with that marriage partner a long time.
Right.
Yeah. where does that fit in with all this? I mean, it adds to the challenge, I would think, if we're continuing to grow, continuing to develop. Maybe what worked at one stage of our life no longer works at another stage.
Right. It goes in circles. Individuation goes also goes in circles. It's not linear, you know. It's like a spiral. And the couple's individuation, you can call it, is also not going in a linear way. It goes in circles, and it's a spiral.
Now, you talked about hope earlier. Do you ever see divorce as a positive outcome of therapy?
Sometimes yes, and sometimes no. I can't say, you know. It depends. It depends of, like I said, the motivation of both partners to change. And it depends also on the rate of their changing, because one can change very quickly and the other very slowly, and then it's a problem. And, you know, sometimes there are situations, for example, of violence or treating the children brutally or by one of their partners, mm-hmm. which I would say the divorce is the best solution ever,
yeah,
you know.
Sure. Well, you started to earlier on to talk about something, and I said, oh, let's put that off. And I was referring to your final chapter, which is on attraction through repulsion, which is interesting.
Yeah.
Often when couples talk about how they first met on quiz shows or things like that or in gatherings of friends, the woman or the man will say, I couldn't stand him or her at first. I would have said this would be the last person I'd marry. So,
yeah.
And then there's the common wisdom that says opposites attract. So tell us about attraction through repulsion and what mythology tells us about that.
Well, you know, we are repulsed by our shadow, that part that we don't like about ourselves, that we try to suppress and repress. We don't like it, and our persona doesn't like it, you know, the way we would like to see ourselves and show ourselves to the outside world. And many times in the shadow part, there are buried parts of us that are important to us. Maybe creativity, maybe different parts of us that should go into the light. And usually when we meet someone in a party or somewhere else, and this someone is our shadow or representing our shadow, at first we're repulsed and disgusted. But as time goes on and we get maybe closer to that person, we start to feel attracted because of the shadow, because we can find in this person that the parts that are buried in us and that we don't dare, you know, dare to express. And then the repulsion turns into attraction. And the opposite happens too. We are attracted to a person, and exactly because that person represents the opposite pole of us, and then we get repulsed by that same person. This happens many times.
Now, I think you made reference to a myth, Hestia, and who?
No, Hephaestus.
Oh, okay, yeah, thank you.
Hephaestus and Aphrodite. Aphrodite was the god of love, the beautiful, beautiful goddess of love and sexual attraction. And Hephaestus was the ugliest god there. And he was actually, his legs were hit when his mother Hera threw him down from the sky because she was so angry that he was so ugly, this baby was so ugly. But he learned, he was very good with his hands. He was an artist, and he made these beautiful, beautiful, beautiful things for all the gods. And once he was so mad at his mother, but he wished, you know, that maybe one day she will love him. So he made for her a beautiful golden chair. But when she sat on the chair, she was bound by invisible ropes, and the chair jumped up to the sky. And she started to, you know, to shout, "Hey, Hephaestus, my son, bring me down to earth." And he said, "Only if you give me the most beautiful woman, goddess, to marry. I want Aphrodite." And she said, "What? Are you crazy? You are so ugly. You are a monster." He said, "Okay, so you stay up there." So in the end, she asked her husband, Zeus, the king of the gods, to give Aphrodite to Hephaestus. That's how they married. But of course, this marriage didn't work out because Aphrodite despised Hephaestus. She's an extrovert. I think Aphrodite is an extrovert and Hephaestus is an introvert. He worked there down in his cave on his beautiful things. And she liked, you know, to run around and attract every man around, every man and God around.
This sounds like the man who's in his study or his workshop,
yeah,
working away at his hobby, and yeah, the wife can't get his attention.
Yeah, right. And then the wife starts to look around, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Just so it shows how contemporary all of this stuff is. Now, do you ever make reference to a myth when working with a couple or individual? Is the myth just something that you're holding in the back of your mind, or do you actually bring it out?
Well, it depends. Many times I tell it. I tell it to the couple, or I tell parts of it to the couple. Mm-hmm. But there are times when I hold it in my hand until, you know, until it it's a good time to tell them, or I would never tell them.
Mm-hmm.
I can, you know, there is no recipe for that.
Yeah. Well, coming full circle, at the beginning you talked about how it was the work of Martin Buber that really brought you to the Jungian camp. And I know that you just recently returned from spending time in Germany studying Martin Buber. I guess there's a Martin Buber library there.
There is an archive. Right. There is an archive in Jerusalem, a very big archive, but I found out that there is an archive in Frankfurt where there are letters and texts that we don't have here.
So this sounds like it might be the next book.
Oh, I hope so. I still have to do lots of work has to be done. But wow. It might. I did write, I just finished a novel about Jocasta, the mother of Oedipus. But it's in Hebrew.
Uh-huh. Well, I remember that in the Dream Workshop, I think you were struggling with that novel, right? You shared a dream with us that related to the struggles with the novel. So that's wonderful that you've gotten through it.
Yeah, I did. Do you know what helped me?
I don't.
Dreams.
Really? How so?
Yeah, dreams helped me because I would get stuck and I wouldn't know how to continue. And then a dream will come and show me the way.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah. So I finished it, and I hope to that it gets published. And then, who knows, maybe it will be translated into English too, like the couple.
Yeah, that would be great. Well, as we wind down, I wonder if there are any final points you'd like to make.
The main point that I would like to make is that when a couple gets into this stage of, you know, despair, disappointment, even depression, feeling stuck, they should go to therapy.
Okay.
And you know why I say it? Because in my experience, it's about two-thirds of the times, even more. The woman would bring the man.
Yep.
Unwillingly.
Right.
And I think men should, you know, change their opinions about therapy and couple therapy.
Yeah. Okay, so they should go to therapy. They should probably travel to Jerusalem to go to therapy. Okay. Dr. Tamar Krohn, it's great to speak with you again, and I want to thank you for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
And I thank you for bringing me in.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Dr. Tamar Krohn. I feel so lucky to have had the opportunity to become friends with her as a result of our interactions at the IASD conference last summer in Berkeley. We bonded as people, but at the time I didn't fully appreciate her professional earnestness and achievements. I have to say I'm very impressed by the fact that she's already written 3 novels and is going to be working on another one, not to mention the book we discuss in this interview. This book, The Archetypal Couple, is very readable. In fact, I'd say the tone of it is for the general reader. At the same time, however, it's very thoroughly researched in terms of the mythic material she presents. In some ways, it reminds me of Jean Boland's Goddesses in Every Woman. But Tamar's book strikes me as somewhat deeper and more wide-ranging. Anyone who has read and liked Boland's books is sure to love this one. Also, it will appeal equally, I think, to therapists who work with couples, as well as those who may be struggling in a couple's relationship. Each chapter is organized around a myth and then includes a case history from her own work with couples to illustrate how that archetypal influence is being played out in their relationships. Let me give you a feel for her writing by reading a couple of paragraphs from the final chapter. Humans have been given a gift, the potential for change and transformation. When this potential is not realized, the human being is fixed in unyielding and unchanging structures. It can be said that he or she was taken over and possessed by the archetype, by the mythical image. This is what happens to legendary heroes when they fall under a spell. They are imprisoned in the skin of an animal or in the mold of a monster, stop developing or changing, remain fixed in a permanent structure. Education and molding, traumas and fears, others' projections and expectations onto and from us, all these things fix us in closed, limiting structures. It is not for nothing that in myths and fairy tales, whoever breaks the spell the hero or heroine is under is invariably a prince or princess, a lover or beloved, and it is invariably by an act of love. The prince wakes Beauty, who fell asleep on being pricked by the fatal needle, and by kissing her, the princess returns to life. The princess breaks the spell that bound the prince to the figure of the frog with her kiss. The prince brings Snow White back to life with his kiss. The power of love is such that it is able to see beauty under the monster's figure and life where there is death. Love and relationship make life flow into the couple's encounter and enables each partner to see his or her transformed self in the other's loving gaze. This loving gaze makes it possible to believe in the possibility of change and transformation. End quote. Tamar's book is available in reasonably priced paperback and Kindle editions in the Amazon.com bookstore. I hope you'll use the Amazon widget in the right-hand sidebar on our site to order your copy.
By supporting Shrink Wrap Radio Psychology Interviews, you'll become an enabler. Enabling the world, that is, to free access to uplifting and educational interviews with the leading experts in their respective fields that explore your brain, body, mind, spirit, intuition, leadership, and so much more. Your financial support will help to keep Dr. Dave motivated to continue on his mission to inspire, to educate, and to provide insight.
Thank you, my dear sister Sherry, for that inspiring promo. At least I hope it's inspiring, inspires some action, that is. In fact, I heard from two or three new donors in the past week, so a big thanks to them and all those others of you who've been helping to support the show. By the way, I should remind you that you can also make money through Shrink Wrap Radio for taking surveys from one of my partner companies, Survey Savvy. Just click on their link in the right-hand sidebar to join their panel. You'll earn money every time you take a survey, and we'll get a small cash reward too. And of course, another form of support is transcription, and I'm happy to announce some new transcripts on the site. First, there's a transcript of number 90, going way back, The Language of Dreams with Robert Haas. And I have to thank Anna van der Veest. I'll take a chance on that pronunciation. Thank you, Anna, for transcribing that one and making it available to us. For all of those of you who are interested in dreams, that's a really great interview. And we have transcript of number 330, Unlocking the Emotional Brain with Bruce Ecker by Gemma Sidney. And that interview with Bruce Ecker, I just think his work is so important. I am really super glad to have a transcript of that that I can refer to from time to time. And finally, we have number 315, which is Sexuality and the Religious Imagination with Jungian analyst Bradley Topaski. And that was done by Gloria Allman. And so thank you for that, Gloria. That one just came in today, just under the wire to get announced here. So let me know if you'd like to try your hand at transcription. It's a great way to deepen your understanding of an interview. It really gets deep into your brain, hearing it again, and channeling it through your fingers. And if you're interested in maybe being a transcriptionist, if you scroll down the transcripts page, you'll see ones marked in red that need to be done. Those are ones that somebody in the past thought they would do, but then did not come through with on. And of course, that doesn't list all of the ones that could stand to be done, because you'll notice that there will be numbers that are not represented on that page. And so if you see some missing numbers, and that's one that you're particularly interested in, then you should contact me about that. I don't know if that explanation was very clear. Hope you followed that. If you are a new listener, you might not be aware that there are a variety of ways to listen to the show. Of course, you can do it through iTunes, and we hope that you'll become a subscriber there. Most people find the best way to listen is while on the go. And for that, I'd recommend either that you purchase our iOS or Android app, and you can find info about them on the Apps tab on our site. Another way to go is Stitcher, which is free. However, I think Stitcher doesn't put the whole list of shows on your device in the way that our app does. Our app has some nice features that you won't find on Stitcher, but Stitcher is free. I'm working on getting out another neuroscience-related continuing education course, and I'll be sure to let you know when that becomes available.
Hi, this is author and professor Louis Cozzolino, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dr. Louis Cozzolino, who will be my next guest. More about that in a bit. Now let's go to some recent emails from our listener community. First, we hear from Beth, who dropped a quick note in response to my thanks for her donation. Beth writes, "Thanks for all you do. I'm a working mom, and this is a great way to stay on top of things as I can listen during my commute." And she signs it, Beth. You know, people often ask me to characterize my audience. So in addition to people who listen while running and people who listen while gardening and people who are in the mental health professions and so on. So now I can add a new category, working moms who listen on their commute. Here's one from Ivy in the Philippines, and she writes, "Hello, Dr. Dave. I'm a psychology graduate student, and I have recently subscribed to your podcast. I only stumbled upon it by accident, and this accident I am most happy about. If only all accidents were like this." Yes, I agree. "By the way, had I known about your podcast before, I'm quite sure I wouldn't miss yours, even if I am not a graduate student. Your interviews make topics simpler to understand, even for a layman, and the topics are really interesting. And for that, I thank you from the bottom of my heart, because I really learn a lot." It's great to hear, Ivy. She goes on to say, "I've been listening to your podcast for 2 weeks now, and I've already finished more than 10 interviews. So far, these interviews are educational. I've only come up with 10 so far, because I make sure that my attention is not divided while listening to it. That's how interesting your interviews are, that I can't afford to get distracted while listening. Even if there are still lots of interviews that I have to listen to, I also want to volunteer for transcribing an interview for this week if there is an interview that needs to be transcribed. I'm not sure if I can keep this up, the transcribing, regularly, but as for this week, I would like to transcribe one if possible. Thank you, Dr. Dave, for putting up such a wonderful show. You are very helpful in informing people about psychology. Cheers." And that's from Ivy in the Philippines. And cheers is right. It really cheers me up to hear from a student like this and to get her fresh enthusiasm, having just discovered the show. And I particularly appreciate Ivy's volunteering to try her hand at being a transcriptionist. So I went ahead and assigned her number 333, Developments in Energy Therapy with David Feinstein. And I'm really looking forward to getting that transcript. I found his work very thought-provoking, and I'd like to be able to look back over a transcript and refer to it in the past, and I'm definitely going to be working it into one of my continuing education courses. So a transcript will be very helpful for that purpose. Here's one that was posted in the comments area from Listener PC up in Vancouver, Canada. PC has been working her way through all the back episodes, and so she wrote in response to number 74 on behavioral medicine, Chinese medicine, and monastic psychology with Brother Bernard Seif. Remember that one? And PC writes, "Oh, what a delightful man." She's referring to Brother Bernard Seif, not me. She writes, "Oh, what a delightful man, pure joy and love, and a trailblazer. What a fine individual, and how well he serves his calling. My personal axiom is that the credence of somebody's words rests on their credibility as a person, and Brother Bernard comes across as one of the few that I'd consider trusting implicitly. While it's wonderful to listen to shows where I'm learning something factual, listening and being uplifted, inspired, and delighted by a person is just joyful. A great listen on a Sunday morning, PC." I couldn't agree more, PC. It's been some time since I've heard from Brother Seif. So, Brother Seif, if you're still out there, Brother Bernard, I should say, I'd love to hear from you again. Get updated. PC also commented on a more recent episode, my interview with Jamal Yogis on his book, The Fear Project. And in the comments area on that show, PC wrote, "For me, and to paraphrase Marshall McLuhan, the messenger is the message, and what a powerful message the man himself is. He certainly walks the Buddha talk in recounting experiences that he has personally encountered. On a personal note, this show is highly relevant in a synchronistic sense because I've been preparing myself to face and transcend a deep-seated fear. It was deeply gratifying to hear Jamal's perspective and approach on such an endeavor. Thanks, Jamal." At a professional working level, what Jamal said about there being no one-size-fits-all intervention on fear desensitization and that a nuanced approach is required makes profound sense. I think it is this fine discernment of the application of solutions and interventions that is, and always has been, what differentiates the effectiveness of recommendations or otherwise. Thanks, Jamal and Dr. Dave, for a quality show." And again, that's signed PC. Well, Richard, another listener in British Columbia who's written before, posted a reply to PC's comment about the interview with Jamal Yogis. And he writes, "I echo PC's comment about the nuanced approach to fear desensitization being the best one. When I first saw the intro to this episode, I thought, oh, brother, what does this guy know? I was thinking it was going to be another grasp the thistle message full of manly man talk, but wow, was I pleasantly surprised. I've never heard that expression before, grasp the thistle. I guess it's kind of like walking on coals, a way of showing your manhood by doing something that hurts. Huh? Richard goes on to say, "Jamal, I really appreciate your genuine style and the honest way you shared about your own fears and about how fear can be a barrier to relationships and other things in life we want to dive into. It illustrates Brené Brown's findings that vulnerability and courage are linked. I love the idea that desire is a curious antithesis to fear. I think you have struck on a true Kierkegaardian dialectic when you talked about fear being primal, but desire slash attraction being even more primal. Wow, that really made sense for me and was actually elating. I realize that my own outdoor activities of late have been an attempt to balance fear with attraction. Now I have a whole new idea to explore. Dave, thanks for your own enthusiastic endorsement of Jamal's work. It helped me stick with the interview, and boy, did that pay off. Your own reflections on your youthful, daring activities now make more sense to me. I wonder what you thought of me before. He goes on to say, another outstanding interview. Jamal's book is going on my wish list. Thanks, Richard. Thank you, Richard. I don't know if people recall my reading a very long and meaningful reply from Richard earlier, some sessions back. Richard is an author in his own right and lives in the British Canadian woods. And I think I'm going to have him on as a guest if he's willing. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Remember that in addition to emails, you can leave comments, as you just heard, about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And occasionally I'll read those comments as if they were an email, but not always. You can have voicemails. You can leave voicemails on Skype. Our name there is ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on our phone, hardly anybody ever does, at 206-337-0622. You can also leave voicemails on our iPhone/Android app, and you can get the full details about that on the apps tab on our site. Thanks to my good friend, Israeli Jungian analyst, Dr. Tamar Krohn, for sharing her work on the couple archetype. My next guest will be Dr. Louis Cozzolino, professor at Pepperdine University and a prolific neuroscience author, and we'll be discussing the importance of neuroscience for psychotherapists. That'll be a good one. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know. And just enough to make you dangerous.